Morning. My name, as Scott said, is Joseph Lee, and I'm a master's student in the Department of Maternal and Child Health at the UNC School of Public Health, which, just so you know, will be the Dennis and Joan Gilling School of Global Public Health in the spring, so you guys have a heads up on that. I owe considerable thanks to my advisor, Dr. Kathy Melvin, who's also with the National Partnership to Help Pregnant Smokers Quit, and my friend and colleague, Gabe Griffin, who unfortunately had to fly off to a med school interview and isn't here to get recognized. And although I wasn't smoking, I was lucky enough to meet a wonderful public health librarian who helped me through this process at the Health Sciences Library in UNC. But all of the errors and misstatements I'm going to make, I'm going to claim as my own. So first, let me begin with a brief introduction about why I'm talking about sexual minority tobacco control. And then I'd like to quickly make sure we're all on the same page about the terminology I'm going to be using. Following that, I'm going to talk about a systematic review of the tobacco control literature that we did, and how the evidence from that process could be applied to tobacco control interventions and research. Now, I'm going to sort of overlay that onto a total quality management, or TQM, framework, which I'll also discuss very briefly. Hopefully, all of that will come together to show how some of what we found in this systematic review of the literature could help provide an evidence base for further work around the country, further research around the country, and give a better sense of where we are today. So, why tobacco control and sexual minorities? Tobacco is a leading cause of disability-adjusted life years, as lost around the world, as you certainly know. And tobacco has long been known to be a causal factor in the etiology of many chronic diseases and cancers. But that's sort of reiterating what everyone already knows. Because of vulnerability during fetal and childhood development, tobacco exposure is particularly detrimental during pregnancy and childhood, which I think has relevance for our communities here, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. As tobacco companies have had to move away and even renounce their health claims and lose some of their advertising venues, it makes sense for them to attach identity to marketing, which is sort of what you can see on this slide. And that could be in Camel number 9 to Chic Young, 18 plus, of course, women, or the short-lived and rather egregious brand, Uptown brand, which was marketed to black men and women in cities, also 18 plus, of course. As I'm going to be using several terms for sexual orientation, I'd like to give a little bit of definition to them, just so we're all on the same page. Sexual minority is the term I am going to be using to encompass identity, so that's gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and the partially reclaimed queer, as well as behavior and attraction and desire. So that's all sort of encapsulated in there together. Unfortunately, none of the studies we examined included measures of tobacco use in transgender populations. But I think it's important to remember that the sampling, the methodology, and then especially these definitions of sexual identity, behavior, and self-reported attraction have made estimating tobacco use prevalence rather difficult. So in January 2000, we did a review looking for other reviews of tobacco in lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender populations, and we found two published reviews on the subject. Only the earlier of these from 2001 was a systematic review, meaning that two people independently read all the abstracts, coded them, and then went through and I pulled the articles that both of them agreed should met the inclusion criteria, and then those were read and to make sure they met the inclusion criteria. Heather Ryan and colleagues found what appeared to be higher rates of tobacco use among lesbian women, gay men, and bisexual men and women. The 6 years following the publication of Ryan's systematic review have seen considerable interest in LGBT tobacco control work, including continued work by the National LGBT Tobacco Control Network, which organizes annual conferences and disseminates materials through its website, including this new Quitline poster that you can see here, which is quite nice. And I'd also be remiss not to mention CLASH, the Coalition of Lavender Americans on Smoking and Health, which has done lots of groundbreaking work around the country. So we set out to update the Ryan and colleagues systematic review. Our systematic review was done using the standard procedures, sort of as I just outlined. And we searched these databases. The bolded ones that you can see were also used in the Ryan study. The struck through ones were used by the Ryan study, but were not available to us. And importantly, the search was not restricted to the English language. These searches yielded over 1,000 citations. We eliminated over 400 as duplicates, typos, books, and dissertations, which didn't meet inclusion criteria. And you can kind of see how the numbers broke down. We identified tobacco articles on tobacco marketing that related to sexual minorities, but we didn't search in any advertising or marketing-specific journals or databases unless they were included in those previous sort of health-related ones that I showed. Like Ryan and colleagues, we kicked out our studies involving HIV/AIDS, overseas sampling, and studies sampled before 1987. And this is our search string, which I think was relatively sensitive. The same principles apply. The bolded ones were in the original article that we were sort of trying to replicate and add to. And we dropped two keywords, being prevalence and epidemiology. So as I'm going to present some of the findings from this systematic review in a total quality management framework, a little bit of background would be helpful. There's many, so we don't need to get all into the quality improvement literature. There's whole camps of different versions from total quality management to quality, continuous quality improvement, and so on and so forth. And everyone in every field more or less uses something similar. So don't get caught up in my specific process, but think of it as a way of presenting the evidence. TQM originally came from Japanese automobile manufacturing, and to simplify, it just gives a way or a system to think through a problem. In their case, it'd be a loose bolt in a Subaru. For us, it's much more complicated in a lot of ways. After identifying the problem, setting targets, and thinking through the causes of the problem, one can identify potential interventions, and then the TQM process would help rank the interventions based on effectiveness, feasibility, etc. Following that one, we try to standardize them, think through future plans. And so that's usually thought of as an internal manufacturing process or an internal health systems process, but you can think of it as sort of an external quality improvement program in tobacco control, because no single organization can do this on their own. So this has to be multiple organizations working together. So that's an external quality improvement process if you care about the quality improvement literature. So I'm going to walk you through this 8-step framework and overlay the evidence base we identified in our systematic review. And even if you think about your programs, your research, and different framework, the general steps and information should still be helpful. So while anyone who's been paying attention for the last 50 years knows that tobacco is a problem, it's useful to point out that the World Health Organization lists it at the top of its risk factors for the loss of disability-adjusted life years in the first world. So it's well above what I consider the rather problematic category of simply unsafe sex, and also well above physical inactivity and nutrition. And so we're still talking about a large problem. And tobacco control, at least in my field, is thought of as not quite as interesting as lots of other things, but I wanted to reiterate that it's still there. The two systematic reviews I mentioned earlier have reported rates on tobacco usage that are likely elevated for lesbian, gay, and bisexual men and women. Our systematic review seems to be showing something simpler, but we're not reporting on that today. So these are just some of the articles, and the numbers are my endnotes that you'll get at the very end. These are just some of the odds ratios and confidence intervals you can find in the tobacco control literature among sexual minorities. And important to note, if the rates were equal for your comparison population, which is straight or heterosexual individuals, and the sexual minority population, then the odds ratio here in pink would be about at 1. But you can see it's sort of trending higher towards around 2, which means sort of double the rate. But, of course, sampling is complicated, and it's difficult to know exactly where we are. So where should we be aiming to eliminate health disparities in tobacco? The national average in 2005 was about 21% of the adult population smoking, and that's from the National Health Interview Survey. And you can ignore my rather detailed set of footnotes there on the side, but I wanted them somewhere. Individual programs would have to have a conversation with themselves about their local area that they're working with and what would be a reasonable target. Now, this is where it gets more interesting and more complicated to a certain extent. the evidence base for why disparities in tobacco use in sexual minority populations has been slowly growing. And I've tried to summarize the findings we've found in our systematic review on this Ishikawa fishbone diagram. The numbers, again, are my end notes. You'll get them at the end. And this should be useful in thinking about where one's program would try to intervene. And it's my perception that four distinct areas emerge from the literature. First, in the upper right-hand corner, targeted marketing by tobacco companies is clearly evident, and the widespread exposure to both commercial and non-commercial tobacco imagery in gay and lesbian print media has been nicely documented by Elizabeth Smith and colleagues at University of California, San Francisco. Tobacco company marketing efforts well-honed on African Americans were deployed on gay and lesbian media and organizations, particularly after the ACT UP boycott of Philip Morris, which was used to pressure my delightful fellow North Carolinian, Jesse Helms. So when Clash and the California Department of Health and Human Services ask, as they do in one of their tobacco interventions, when did tobacco become part of us, as we can answer, it's basically when big tobacco targeted us with marketing. Moving on to the next fin of the diagram, community space in the upper left-hand corner, there's evidence that gay and lesbian neighborhoods have been targeted for the ubiquitous availability of tobacco products. So R.J. Reynolds' Project SCUM, that's Subculture Urban Market, had this as its goal in San Francisco's Castro District. Tobacco, clubbing, gay and lesbian bars have also long been intertwined. And tobacco is, of course, available and marketed in many bars, no matter their type, that are not privileged to fall under a smoke-free ordinance. For sexual minority communities, however, gay and lesbian bars have, according to the literature, long been one of the few safe community spaces, or at least been one of the community spaces. And there's some evidence that this, along with the alcohol, cigarette, hey, can I have a light, effect and combination, contributes to tobacco disparities. And if you're not in the bar, but instead out to the theater arts, remember, big tobacco is a patron of both. So in the lower left-hand corner, Gary Ramaffetti at the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, has documented stress and discrimination as contributing to tobacco use among youth in a series of qualitative studies. So most youth reported tobacco use basically as a coping mechanism, and these youths reported the use of tobacco as well as in looking tough. That youth use tobacco as a coping measure for violence, stress, and discrimination should not be surprising, and may influence the tobacco disparities we see. Most youth risk behavior surveillance systems, those YRBS surveys, report violence directed at sexual minority adolescents at high rates if they collect data on sexual orientation. In the lower right-hand corner, Gregory Greenwood and colleagues provided the only study we found on cessation. And while the data are limited to urban men who have sex with men, that was their definition, they document a low use of among former smokers of evidence-based interventions, like nicotine replacement and the utilization of healthcare providers in smoking cessation. Interestingly, these former smokers have more gay and lesbian friends than do current smokers, and additionally, having few or no friends who smoke was also associated with being a former rather than current smoker. That should be straightforward. So that is most of the currently published knowledge about the causality of tobacco disparities specific to sexual minority communities found in our systematic review. Now, it's important to note that this was a systematic review. It examined only the peer-reviewed literature in the health professions, journals, and databases. So all of the expert knowledge out there that isn't published is not included. And you can sort of see, I mean, in the Ishikawa diagram, all of these things work together. So I'm not saying this is for completely discrete things. I'm saying they all seem to flow together to influence this. So seeing those multiple causes helps one brainstorm potential ways to intervene. These include counter-marketing through mass media, and this is all from the literature as well, suggested interventions, social marketing campaigns around cessation services, and a reminder from youth that no one likes to be told what to do, particularly if you're an adolescent. I'm 20-something, in particular, it goes on from there. And youth also reported a desire for interactive programming, creating smoke-free social events with food, I wanted to make that very specific, and being involved in the creation of the intervention, and including the target population in the in the intervention design process, is of course A, part of total quality management, B, part of most every other good program design process. Other options in the literature include building self-esteem and peer support, so kind of building those resources, as well as integrating tobacco control measures into other health and wellness programs and not siloing it off. So our systematic review identified no articles that discussed asking gay and lesbian bars to go smoke-free voluntarily, nor did we identify any articles that discussed smoke-free ordinances in any locations. Quitlines, the five A's for clinicians, that's ask, advise, assess, assist, and arrange, we didn't find anything about either of those in relation to sexual minority communities. So those all remain possibilities and remain open for further research. Unfortunately, and I want to emphasize this, we were unable to find a single evaluation of any program, intervention, policy, or activity regarding sexual minority tobacco control published in the peer-reviewed literature. This hinders the ability to refine or improve programs and tell what works in our communities. As programs that work are developed, our goal in quality improvement is to ensure their continuity. This is the standardization part of the TQM process. So, in thinking through this, I have to think about high-quality data to monitor use trends in youth and adults as needed from large population-based surveys. The National LGBT Tobacco Control Network is providing excellent training, education, dissemination, advocacy services around the country, but it has to work with a limited base of evidence and best practices. And it's important to make sure that sexual minority communities have access to the standard evidence-based programs while we continue to evaluate their effect in our communities and evaluate additional programs. These include providers using the five A's, as I mentioned, quit lines being promoted, and that there's access to nicotine replacement. Finally, thinking forward, we still lack data on tobacco prevalence in gay and lesbian families with children. We identified one study, but it reported only on a convenient sample of women in the Bronx. These data may exist in two household surveys, albeit with perhaps too small of numbers. It may be possible to tease out tobacco usage rates among families in the 1996 National Household Survey on Drug Abuse, because it asked about family relationships and partners and their genders, and the National Health Interview Survey, which is used for asthma and same-sex partnered relationships, households rather. And we lack strong data on race and ethnicity in tobacco in sexual minority communities, and we have a glaring lack of information on tobacco in transgender communities. It would be helpful to have more information about the reach of quitlines to sexual minority communities and to have evaluations of cessation programs. So, to conclude, I've given you an overview, I think, of what is most of the published literature on tobacco control in sexual minority communities. And it seems quite apparent that disparities exist. And while tobacco companies continue to equate, as American Spirit does here, smokers' rights with marriage equality rights, it's not all good in sexual minority tobacco control. And this is actually, this is not new or isolated to American Spirit. This is an old tactic. But there is good work being done by advocates and researchers around the country. Thank you for your time.